Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM.
Hello and welcome to Alaska Edition. I'm Grace Jang with CBS 11 News, in for Michael Carey today. Our panelists today are Brendan Kelly Helenthal with Anchorage Press and Kyle Hopkins with Anchorage Daily News. Thank you both so much for being here. Brendan, let's start with you. The Occupy Anchorage movement, it grew out of the Occupy Wall Street movement, which garnered a lot of national attention, and a lot of smaller sort of Occupy Denver, Occupy Anchorage movement came out. Can you tell us about
that? I saw an Occupy the Tundra photo making its way around Facebook yesterday. So basically the Occupy Wall Street movement is, they're saying, get corporate money and corporate influence out of politics. Corporate personhood, I think, is the point that they're trying to make in Zuccotti Park out there. And then our local conservative talk radio contingent here in Anchorage, after their a few weeks later, there was an Occupy Anchorage movement that set up in Town Square Park, and, you know, they had some signs, and they got a lot of criticism from basically the talk radio contingent about, you know, what are you occupying? And so this week in the Anchorage Press, what I did was have two of my contributing writers, who are both opinion writers, John Arono and Mike Dingman, write it. Basically, this is what Occupy Anchorage is about, and this is why Occupy Anchorage is just silliness. And on the pro side, what John Arono wrote about basically is that this isn't just something that's New York based or just Wall Street based. That it's a nationwide movement against corporate personhood and against corporate influence and politics in particular, and taking democracy back. And he wrote, you know, there's this misconception that it's all this leftist, Obama-loving, you know, hippies, basically. And he goes on to criticize the president for the amount of money that he's raised in his campaign, and just use that as an example of what the Occupy Wall Street and Occupy Anchorage movements are against. Dingman's take on it, the conservative take on it, is, you know, this is a bunch of people who are putting makeup on their faces and showing up at Town Square Park. And while on September 17th, protesters went to Zuccotti Park down next to Wall Street in New York, they stayed. On October 5th at 5:30 p.m., some people went down to Town Square, and then they left before dinner time. So that's sort of the pros and the cons, left and the right version of it.
So would you say there's a uniquely Alaskan message to Occupy Anchorage?
I don't know that there is a uniquely Alaskan one. Somebody made the point to me that if they really wanted to occupy somewhere, they should go occupy between the Atwood building, where the governor's office is, and the ConocoPhillips building. But then again, PFDs just came out, so who wants to do that?
We're going to talk about PFDs in a bit, but let's move now to an Anchorage crime story. Kyle, you had exclusive access to the surrender of a man that Anchorage police had been looking for earlier this week for several days. Can you tell us about that?
Well, this is a story of the early Monday morning shooting outside JJ's Lounge in East Anchorage. Two men were killed, a man and a woman were injured, and on Tuesday and Wednesday, immediately after the shooting, we didn't know who shot who. You know, we knew two people were dead. We didn't know what led up to it, except the bar owner said there was some kind of, you know, some words spoken inside the bar. Something, you know, escalated. It went outside. There were kind of two camps or groups of people. And on Tuesday and Wednesday, police were looking for a man who turned out to be the brother of one of the men who was dead. He was described as a person of interest. His name was Lee Chi Chang. And so what happened on, I guess it was Wednesday night, right, is we tagged along as Mr. Chang had contacted Rex Butler, as his defense lawyer. And so what Butler was doing was, kind of looking to deliver Mr. Chang to the police. You know, the police are saying, like, we consider this guy a person of interest. They weren't saying, like, what they wanted him for at that point. But he had to come in and talk to police somehow. And so his lawyer saying, well, we're going to try and do this in a, you know, peacefully. We don't want to have any mishaps, any surprises. We don't want our guy getting shot, but also we don't want our guy talking to the police. Right. The lawyer wants to be there and make sure, And so it was interesting to see that play out, because that's usually not something you see, which was, you know, the lawyer talking to the, you know, what turned out to be a murder suspect. I mean, he's now a suspect in the murder of,
Emilio
Ramirez. You know, police say that Mr. Chang shot Emilio Ramirez at point blank range. And we don't know what his motives are yet. But anyway, at the time, he had not been charged yet. But, we're in the office downtown of Rex Butler, and Mr. Chang is, you know, just kind of sitting there, and he's looking nervous. He's not looking super nervous or super afraid, but he's, you know, he's clearly uncomfortable and concerned. And so the lawyer is just saying, look, when we get there, don't say anything. I don't want you making any statement, you know. And then Rex Butler and his associate, Tank Jones, were
those
just
very
kind of
interesting characters.
Right. Yeah. Kind of like in the idea of like Anchorage is soap opera. Those are kind of two main characters in our Anchorage soap opera, right?
He's been called the Johnny Cochran of Anchorage. Yeah.
Levi wasn't there.
Levi was not there. But you can see, you know, you can see kind of the dynamic between those two, where they were just kind of talking about the idea of like, I mean, everyone who's watched, you know, CSI or any cop show knows, oh, you're not supposed to talk to the police or whatever. But those guys were just kind of talking about like why, you know, the idea behind that.
Now, did Rex Butler approach Lee Chi Chang or the other way around?
I don't know how those two came to be. I mean, this is not the first time Rex Butler has done this.
Where he's brought people
where
to
he
police.
Has, you know, he becomes the lawyer for someone who's in big trouble. Yeah. Someone who the police are looking for, who they believe killed somebody, who, you know, they, you know, who knows how that could happen? Who knows how that how things could get very bad, like when they first come into contact with this person. So the lawyer's role is to kind of, you know, is to usher him into the police department without any mishaps, and then also kind of keep him from saying anything that might get him in trouble later. I actually don't know how those two connected. You know, Butler just calls the police and says, hey, I have this person here. You know, how do you want to do this? And then they all get into this white Cadillac and drive down to, and this is like, you know, nine or 10 at night. And they all drive down to the police headquarters. And there's just kind of this very low key, very businesslike, you know, hey, how's it going? And they just kind of walk the guy back into the police department. And like, then like an hour later, that's when the warrant comes down, and there's actually an arrest made. And you know, in the meantime, we're just kind of waiting to see exactly what happened. I mean, this has been I've found it to be kind of a confusing shooting, like, mm-hmm. you know, the sequence of events. Guns were handed
murder.
Off, but yeah. It's not clear. It's, you know, you don't really know what police think actually happened. And so it's very much like an ongoing, you know, story. We'll see how
definitely.
It plays out.
Definitely. You get all the best scoops. Speaking of crime, Brendan, Anchorage Press ran a story about a man who wants the governor to pardon him for a crime for which he was convicted and served time. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. The gentleman's name is Brian Petrilli. He's 35 years old, and he is actually a juvenile probation officer at McLaughlin Youth Center. He also is a veteran of McLaughlin Youth Center. When he was 17 years old, with a gun, he armed an Alaska USA Federal Credit Union. He was caught about 15 minutes later. There was never any question of his guilt or innocence. And he went into the juvenile correction system at McLaughlin and was there until he was 20 years old, I believe. So he did time there. He spent a lot of time at McLaughlin. He feels a connection to it, and hence has made a career there as a juvenile probation officer. I don't know, a lot of people may not know, but McLaughlin isn't just like a jail for kids. It's also a school. It's also sort of a community for these, you know, juvenile offenders. So it's not as much punishment as it is, you know, hopefully corrections, and especially with someone like Mr. Petrilla, who's been through the system and who thinks the system helped him, you know, going back in and giving back to that, it helps the atmosphere within McLaughlin be a much more positive and rehabilitative system. Anyway, Mr. Petrilla is trying to get pardoned from the governor for this crime that he committed when he was 17. He basically wants everything to come full circle and, you know, and be cleared. Unfortunately, there are some legal issues with that. Back in 2007, there was some legislation, and this was due to some sketchy sort of pardons that went on under the Murkowski administration. It was actually a corporation that was pardoned, pardoned of criminally negligent homicide.
Avalanche death, right?
Yeah, the avalanche death. So after that, there was new legislation in 2007 that then Governor Sarah Palin signed. But basically since then, they've been trying to interpret what that legislation means. So as of Mr. Christensen, my reporter's reporting last week, there were about 110 requests for clemency sitting at the governor's office. And all the governor's offices can say is the Department of Law hasn't cleared up who's responsible for this yet. The new law said basically that members of the Alaska Parole Board would be granting clemency. And Mr. Petrilla is in a unique situation because his crime was as a juvenile. He was never charged as an adult, and he's actually got a document from the Alaska Parole Board saying, we are not responsible for juvenile cases, and he's like, who is? He wants to clear his name. He wants everything to come full circle, but there are also what he committed is considered a barrier crime. There are certain things you can't get licensed for. He and his wife could not, say, have a daycare in their home. He once applied to be a Border Patrol officer and was turned down because he had an armed robbery on his juvenile record.
Wow. I thought juvenile records were sealed.
They're not sealed when you're trying to be a Border Patrol officer, I believe.
Okay, so there are exceptions. Okay, yeah. Let's turn now to the political corruption cases. Peacock just filed his notice wanting to change his plea. Either of you care to comment on that? Kyle.
Well, you know, this isn't a story I've been covering lately, you know, not since the trials were actually happening. But I think the takeaway, you know, the impact would be that you've got him pleading to a single count of bribery as opposed to, you know, the multiple counts that he was, you know, originally indicted on. It also means you don't have a trial in Fairbanks in December, you know, so I'm sure there are many people happy about kind of avoiding going up there for, you know, to rehash all that again up in Fairbanks in the wintertime. Now we just see what happens with the rest of the cases. I mean, you don't have Ben Anderson going to court. You don't have Ben Stevens going to court. You have, I was thinking of Tom Anderson, who's now out and is doing what? He has like a radio show or something.
His,
you know,
radio show's on right after mine today.
Is it really?
Yes.
is today like the first day?
Today's the second episode of the Ethically Speaking with Tom Anderson.
Okay,
That's he's the name also of the quite program. Active on Facebook.
Yeah, so yes. The point I was trying to make is that, you know, people are kind of moving on and things are kind of winding down.
Do you think that we as Alaskans, our psyche has recovered from that?
Tom Anderson's has. I wanted to ask you, Kyle, if you know, you may have paid more attention to the Cott case than I, but if the judge does sign off on this one bribery charge that he wants to plea out to, it would be time served?
I don't know that.
Okay.
More details to come. Okay, so let's turn now to the entertainment beat. You've been on that for a while. You've had some exclusive access to some big name stars. What can you tell us about the future of the industry in Alaska? Is there an entertainment industry to speak of in Alaska?
We'll see, right? I mean, next week you'll probably start to see the Frozen Ground guys like actually shooting, you know, next week and then like in the coming weeks. I mean, that movie's getting started.
Are you in it?
I'm not in it. No, I've always kind of been tempted to do the auditions and stuff, but I kind of feel like I shouldn't. But
why not?
I did pitch. I did say, hey, can I audition and then just write a story about it? Uh-huh. Right. Well, and they were not into that.
Sheila Toomey's going to be in it playing herself, right?
You'd have to ask her. Okay. I would say, like, I wouldn't be surprised if there's like a Sheila Toomey character, you know. You'd have to ask her if she actually is a guy going to do a cameo or whatever. I mean, Sheila Toomey, you know, the ear or whatever, she was, you know, very much involved in that reporting at the time,
right,
and stuff, and is really familiar with the whole story and wrote a lot of the kind of definitive stories on Butcher Baker when it was happening. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so you'll see that next week, right? And then in the coming weeks. But the question is, what's next?
Right.
Do we actually get this movie called The Peak, which would be a pretty big movie that would be like this mountain rescue movie, like that might happen. There's a dog mushing movie that might happen that also might be kind of like a big budget movie. You know, I'm still learning kind of the ins and outs in the industry, but when you talk to the producers and stuff, it seems like there's no other question except can we get the financing for it, mm-hmm. right? There's all these other things at play, and that's why the tax incentive is kind of like a, it's such a big deal because like, you know, when the rubber meets the road, it's all about whether or not they can get like their movie financed. And so
exactly.
I don't know if after Frozen Ground, I don't know if others have actually gotten their money in hand and they can come do it, you know. And then meantime, real quick, I mean, in the meantime, there's also been kind of smaller projects that have been in the works, like the Voight, you know, the John Voight thing is probably going to premiere this month or next month. And they're actually, he stuck around. Like he made like a bunch of like these kids movies that you'll start to see like early next year, sequels to Baby Geniuses, you know, kind of probably straight to DVD kind of things. But it was a busy, like last year was really busy, and but it's unclear what happens like next.
Do you hear anything about actual television series up here outside of the reality glut?
Yeah, well, you know, they're trying to do the Dana Stabenow uh-huh. thing.
The Kate she got. Yeah. Do you hear about anything else? It seems like something like that might really plant the infrastructure for things to keep perpetuating.
What about a reality show at your respective offices? I think that would be interesting.
Yeah. They've done everything else. I mean, they've done every other single, like, job, you know, every right. job you can think of. So they're welcome to come.
Why not reporter, right?
Yeah.
Is Coolest going to actually be turned into, like, a production studio? Air Force Base, do you think?
I don't know. We'll see. I mean, we'll see. I mean, this idea of like they absolutely need a soundstage mm-hmm. in order to make movies happen. Like maybe that's true, but you know, two movies have come and gone, or not come and gone, but like two movies have committed. You know, Whale/Big Miracle is done. They didn't have like a dedicated soundstage. At least not, you know, a property that was like that's what that is built for, right? Mm-hmm. And these guys, the Frozen Ground guys, they don't have, you know, kind of an official soundstage and stuff. So I wonder about that. I mean, you know, initially in earlier stories, I was around like, wow, you really need the soundstage. But I don't know. I'd like to hear more from producers about whether that's true.
Right. Okay. The PFD glitch, it just broke. The Department of Revenue sent out a notice to all of us media members saying that. Saying that they had made a mistake. It was a processing error and something like 5,500 PFDs went out that shouldn't have.
To people who should have been garnished for one reason or another, I'm assuming child support,
debt.
IRS, yeah. Yeah, interesting. Bad software glitch, guys. I mean, I'm curious how they're going about fixing it, if it's a really simple automatic sort of process to yank that back out of, you know, direct deposits. I know that they did put a stop payment, I believe, on, they said, 1,900 checks, but where does that leave the other 3,600?
We actually got a call, the CBS 11 newsroom got a call from a woman who was really angry because she had used that money to pay off bills, and the next day she looks and she's negative $800 in her account.
That's what's really interesting about that story is, like, you can see, you know, mistakes happen, and it sounds like maybe this was human error slash, you know, the process allowed for it to happen, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the way that they do their database stuff. But yeah, that's what I'd like to hear more about. It's just people who, you know, they probably, you probably know that you weren't supposed to get your PFD. You probably knew, you know, if your PFD is getting garnished, you probably are well aware of that.
Should have called and flagged someone.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. But then the money shows up anyway, and you think, and so, you know, imagine there were like 3,600 of those that were direct deposits. So like that means there's probably like thousands of people who were kind of looking at bank statements and thinking, huh, what do I do? How do I feel about this? And what do I want to do about this? And then, or maybe they didn't even notice and just kind of, you know, spent the money. And I would love to hear some of those stories, people who spent the money and then it got taken back.
I'm sure there's going to be a lot of them coming out, you know, people who have new flat screen TVs. Kicking themselves.
Yeah, maybe there's just a bunch of people like in the return lines at exactly. Best Buy or whatever.
Yeah, don't return anything this weekend. Long lines.
Kyle, you've been working on a story about a near-miss situation between two airplanes. What can you tell us about what you've learned so far?
Well, I'll try and keep that short. I mean, this was a story that was reported just kind of in bits and pieces over a long time. And you know, finally, we finally published a story when there was an official report that was sent to the FAA, and it's a case of, you know, we live in South Central Alaska where there's tons of planes, right? There's also a military base and a military post, and those guys are training, you know, in their big cargo planes. They're training, you know, for missions they're going to do in Afghanistan, you know, dropping people, you know, I'm dropping, you know, paratroopers, dropping cargo and stuff. So they fly this route in South Central that kind of heads north of, you know, here towards Wasilla. And meantime, there are all these small planes, there are trainers who are kind of flying in and out of the Wasilla Airport. And those things happen relatively close to each other. And this was a case of an instructor and her student who were flying, and were just kind of flying along and about to head back to Anchorage. And the student looked out the window and just saw this, you know, field of gray. And this is what she says, right? You know, this field of gray out the window, and realized, and this is like the wing of a big C-17 cargo jet, right? Wow. And kind of, you know, freezes and just, you know, stays straight, and, you know, was not aware that the jet was there. The jet apparently was aware that the smaller plane was there. And the Air Force says, you know what? This was not a near miss. We were not within 500 feet, which is what the FAA constitutes. You know, that's their definition of a near miss. But so you have this kind of he said, she said situation where the FAA is now investigating to see, okay, was this what's called a near mid-air collision? Was it close enough, right? And if it was, like, was anyone at fault? Like, how do you prevent this kind of thing in the future? And, you know, the reason you want to pay attention to that, right, is, you know, for one thing, we've had near mid-air collisions. We've had multiple near mid-airs this year.
Yeah.
I mean, not involving military planes. But it's something that can happen, and so you just want to know, okay, should there be some policy change? You know, the military is not inclined to change their routes, but, you know, is there something that can be done? Can they fly higher? Can the, you know, is there a way that they can communicate better with, or that pilots can do a better job of keeping an eye on kind of where those military planes are, so there's no, you know, nothing in the future happens.
What are your sources telling you? Do they say that there needs to be more oversight?
You know, I think the Air Force feels like they are trying to communicate, and their response is, look, we've been here for decades, right? We haven't been flying C-17s for decades, but we've been here flying routes for a very long time, and we tell you when, you know, when we're up there. And the private pilots say, you know, actually it's not as easy as you say it is, and can you please just, you know, we're down here, can you just fly up here when you're near the Wasilla Airport, you know, so there's no chance of, you know, the two shall meet.
How is that even feasible? Okay, Brendan, anything exciting you're working on?
All sorts of exciting things that I can't tell you about because my competition is sitting across the table from me. No, I'm just kidding. We're going to have some Halloween fun in the Anchorage Press towards the end of the month about some haunted joints around Anchorage. I've got a fantastic essay coming out by our writer, Chris Farman, about his experience building his own log cabin down in Homer. And one I'm very excited about, a profile of a certain cold case prosecutor who's the cold case prosecutor in the Bonnie Craig murder case.
Myovis?
Yes, Myovis. And the killer will be sentenced at the end of the month, and we'll have a story shortly after that about Mr. Myovis.
Kenneth Dion will be sentenced. You got a sit down with Paul Myovis?
One of my writers did. Yes.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Can you tell us?
I shouldn't elaborate.
You shouldn't elaborate. Okay. All right. Got it. Wow, we've got a lot of time.
Well, what have you been working on?
What have I been working on? Well, male-on-male rape was my last I-team investigation that actually happens. There are two men who are kind of notorious. One's name is Kent Thomas, and the other is Kelvin Norris. They, according to police, they target specifically homeless youth, teens who are down and out and can't afford their own cigarettes and alcohol, so according to police, they bribe them. But the thing is, both these men are convicted sex offenders, one in Washington and one here, but you look up their names on the sex offender registry, you can't find either. Because of a 2008 Supreme Court ruling that says if your conviction was before 1994, when the database was created, you're off that list. So once that ruling came down in 2008, the sex offender registry database went from 4,000 to like 2,000. It was just purged. And so these men are on trial, and police have, it's been quite a journey, quite a process for police and prosecutors to get the cases against both men to stick, against Thomas and Norris to stick, because the victims themselves don't show up. Three of the victims didn't show up for the Norris case because they, you know, they're struggling with homelessness and substance abuse issues, and they're also really embarrassed and very ashamed. And I talked to STAR, Standing Together Against Rape Advocates, who say that as tough as it is for women to report, it's that much tougher for men to report because it calls into question, hey, does this mean then that I'm gay? I'm supposed to be tough and strong and I'm supposed to protect myself. How could I have let this happen? So that's interesting. Well, anyway, we are running out of time. Thank you so much. I'm Grace Jang. I'm in for Michael Carey. We're back next week with Alaska Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.